Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Tom Lynch, and to begin, he provided an update on perhaps the most dynamic aspect of the field, the identification of tumor mutations in non-small cell lung cancer and the development of related targeted agents, research that started dramatically 9 years ago when Dr. Lynch and others reported on the discovery of EGFR mutations.
I think as we get more experience with EGFR, we recognize a couple things. First, the original type of mutation matters, whether or not you have an exon 19 deletion or an exon 21 point mutation. Those two types of mutations are by far the most predictive for benefit from tyrosine kinase inhibitors. That we think probably exon 19 deletions do a little bit better and have a slightly better improved survival from TKI therapy. It also matters whether or not you have a concurrent T790M at diagnosis. That turns out to be something we're finding with increasing frequency. The more testing we do and the more sequencing we do as opposed to just doing genotyping. When one does sequencing, you tend to find T790Ms more often because you're looking for it. So a concurrent T790M certainly is a negative prognostic factor and predicts for worse outcome. And then the exon 20 mutations are a group of patients that we really don't have a great evidence that tyrosine kinase inhibitors benefit as much, and that may necessarily not be the right initial way to go with treatment, although there are plenty of anecdotal stories of exon 20 patients benefiting from erlotinib or gefitinib. I also think it's important when you analyze afatinib, erlotinib, gefitinib, that you look at the type of mutations that were used to enter patients into trials. Some just genotyped for exon 19 deletions and exon 21 point mutations. Other studies have looked more broadly, including those patients who had more full sequencing and included more unusual mutations in the mix. Not all mutations are activating, and not all activating mutations are likely to respond to tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So I think a mutation is not a mutation, is not a mutation. It really depends upon, they're all mutations, but the implications of that can be different.
So I'm curious what your thoughts are about the recently approved EGFR TKI afatinib. Can you talk a little bit about what it is, what we know about it, and how you see it being integrated into practice?
So I think afatinib offers great promise in a number of ways. First, it's an irreversible inhibitor. It irreversibly binds to EGFR, and there may be advantages to that. Second, it not only has good affinity for inhibiting EGFR, but also has activity against HER2. So this may be an agent that my breast cancer colleagues and doctors who are in practice who treat breast cancer may end up using down the road. We don't know that yet. So those are the two distinguishing factors, HER2 activity and the fact that it's irreversible. The data that led to the approval of afatinib are pretty straightforward and show that afatinib offers a similar degree of benefit to erlotinib and gefitinib in patients who have mutations up front. So it offers another option for doctors and patients in the first-line setting. I guess, Neil, the place where I'm the most excited about afatinib is in its combination with cetuximab in the setting of resistance. There is terrific evidence. It's probably the best developed combination now that cetuximab plus afatinib are able to cause response in patients who have acquired resistance. And that's going to lead to several trials. One, looking at the question of, does that response lead to improved survival? And the second question is, does it make sense to use afatinib and cetuximab as first-line therapy? Now, obviously, the combination of afatinib and cetuximab will have greater toxicity in all likelihood than just a TKI alone. So not only do you have to determine is it better in terms of efficacy, but you have to balance that off against what is likely to be increased toxicity of the combination regimen. But I think that's a property of afatinib that we don't see with erlotinib and gefitinib up front.
And do you see or have you even tried to access this combination outside of a trial setting?
I haven't yet tried to use it outside of a clinical trial setting. I think it's still a little bit early, but I do wonder how this will be received by carriers. My hope is that for patients who've had a great initial response to erlotinib or gefitinib, that insurance carriers see the potential for afatinib and cetuximab and see that there is published evidence that suggests that there's a benefit. But Neil, as you know, and as all of your listeners know, it's often very difficult to predict how various different insurance carriers will interpret the data.
What do we know about the toxicity profile of afatinib compared to, for example, erlotinib? And what do we know about the toxicity profile of the combination of cetuximab and afatinib?
So what we know is that afatinib as a single agent causes diarrhea, rash, very similar to erlotinib and very similar to gefitinib. I think most people feel that there may be slightly more rash or diarrhea to afatinib, although that is not a proven point. That's just something that people have observed. I think people think it might be a little more efficacious, a little bit stronger TKI in that setting. But again, that hasn't been proved either, but that's certainly a perception that may be out there. What we do know is that the combination of afatinib and cetuximab is certainly associated with more GI symptoms, more diarrhea, more rash, more paronychiae, some of the skin lesions that people get in their fingernails and toenails, than what we see with a single agent TKI, be it afatinib or erlotinib or gefitinib. So again, it may be, particularly in the combination, a trade-off of toxicity versus hopefully improved efficacy. And again, we need large randomized trials to be able to determine if there is benefit in that setting.
I was just kind of flashing on the fact that, you know, we know there's certain sort of allergic belts, so to speak, North Carolina and the middle United States, where you frequently see cetuximab reactions, sometimes really severe. There, you know, for example, in colon cancer, they use panitumumab. How would you feel about, at least theoretically, about using panitumumab and afatinib?
So that's a great question. I know we have a lot of colleagues in Tennessee, North Carolina, parts of Virginia, where that's very important. We have a relationship with Sarah Cannon at Yale. And I know that David Spiegel, who runs the lung group at Sarah Cannon, is quite worried about cetuximab and its ability to cause reactions. I guess my only concern is we just don't have evidence for panitumumab in that setting. And I would be very hesitant to do that. And the only reason I say that is that afatinib works, whereas erlotinib and gefitinib didn't in this setting. And I think you have to be careful. There are some differences between the antibodies, although I think it makes good sense for folks to try to develop evidence that you can use panitumumab in that setting.
What about using afatinib as a single agent? Would you consider using it instead of erlotinib? Would you consider using it after erlotinib?
So yes, I think that afatinib is definitely part of the armamentarium that doctors can use and can choose where to use it. I think that its indication suggests that it's an active drug, at least as active as erlotinib and gefitinib. And I think there will be doctors and patients who choose afatinib as first-line therapy as single agents. I don't think it's going to be an agent used much, nor will any of them be used much in second-line treatment of resistance unless you have cetuximab with it. I don't think any of these drugs have terrific potential in second-line once you're truly refractory. Now, Neil, that's different than the question of continuing TKI in the setting of progression, because I think many of us now believe very strongly that in many types of progression, and I know at many of the meetings and think tanks that you've put together, we've talked a lot about this idea of patients who progress very slowly on TKIs. We keep the TKI going and either resect a cancer or watch a cancer or add a chemotherapy agent to it. I think you'll see afatinib used that way, but I don't think you'll see it truly used in the setting of refractory disease unless it's being given cetuximab. I think it'll either be used upfront in first line, which is the FDA indication, similar to the FDA indication for erlotinib, and in the rest of the world, the FDA indication for gefitinib.
And certainly that concept of continuation of progression, we've seen that anti-HER therapy in breast cancer more recently, anti-angiogenic therapy, bevacizumab specifically in colorectal cancer. Is that generally what you do in a patient, you know, a common situation who, you know, say 9 months or a year into erlotinib has disease progression, it's not necessarily all that explosive? Do you generally continue it?
So I did that last week. I had a patient that I've been following who last week came in with an area that was very subtly different. I had seen that initially about 4 months ago. I asked her to come back for another CAT scan 3 months after the one that we saw. And last week we went over the results of that. And it showed, again, very subtle progression. So in that case, I haven't done anything. I've continued the erlotinib for that patient. And my feeling is, you know, it might be a year or two, or even if it's a half a year before I have to make a move. I think that's helpful. I also think the concept of local therapy could be considered in the setting of someone who has had a great response up front, that local therapy could be in the CNS, that local therapy could be distant. I mean, Neil, just last week, one of the new patients I saw presented with an EGFR mutation, an exon 19 deletion, and multiple brain metastasis. I've started that patient on erlotinib frontline, and the patient's having a beautiful response initially after just a couple of weeks. Now, let's say it's a year from now, and one of the brain lesions begins to grow. I would continue the erlotinib and do SRS to a brain lesion, and even consider that for body lesions, because I think, you know, managing these patients is a little bit different than the way we traditionally think of the chemotherapy paradigm, where any sign of progression, you really stop the chemo and switch. I think in the TKI setting of oncogene addiction and mutation, I think continuing some TKI makes sense as you do other things.
So let's talk a little bit about immunotherapy, certainly one of the more interesting developments over the last couple of years in lung cancer. And you've been in the middle of this, as well as your colleague Roy Herbst. Can you talk about what we know about ipilimumab, but also anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1 that we saw some data from that was really exciting at ASCO?
So, Neil, I think that this is an area of extraordinary enthusiasm in lung cancer. Of all the drugs that we've seen developed, this class of agents appears to have very broad activity. So let's look at them as individual agents. So ipilimumab, my group is involved in studies of ipilimumab plus chemotherapy in small cell and non-small cell lung cancer. And there were some hints in small cell and some hints in squamous cell that progression-free survival was better with the combination of ipilimumab plus chemotherapy. And that's being looked at now in phase 3 trials. There aren't any single agent data with ipilimumab in lung cancer. It's only with chemotherapy. So I get asked this question a lot by practicing docs who say to me, Tom, can I use ipi as a single agent the way I do in melanoma? And my answer is no, we just don't have any evidence for that at this point. And even the evidence from our phase 2 trials really needs confirmation in phase 3 trials. Having taken care of many patients who've gotten ipilimumab as single agent at Yale in the melanoma program when I'm on service, you know, this is not a drug that's without toxicity. It's a drug where you have to manage toxicity very, very carefully. My colleague Mario Schnall and Harriet Kluger treat a lot of patients with ipi, and managing colitis, managing hepatitis, very important how you do that. And I certainly would not use ipi for lung cancer patients without more evidence. Now, anti-PD-1, on the other hand, we don't have combination evidence yet. Some phase 2 data is being developed, but we have terrific single agent evidence with PD-1 and PD-L1. Anti-PD-L1, anti-PD-1 look very potent in lung cancer with single agent response rates around 20%. The big question is, how do you determine who's going to respond? What are the biomarkers to predict response? Does PD-1 expression itself turn out to be the most important predictor of outcome? Again, early hints that it might, but also very early data, way too small numbers to make any kind of conclusions. There are 4 to 5 companies developing these drugs. A common question I get asked, Neil, is anti-PD-L1 as good as anti-PD-1? I don't think we know at this point. I think that there is evidence that both have activity, and I think that that will be a question that will need to be developed. I can tell you one thing I'm very excited about is combination immunotherapy, is the combination of ipilimumab and anti-PD-1. And that's being developed. It was reported at ASCO this year in melanoma and renal cell as having activity and having an acceptable side effect profile. Can't wait to see that developed in lung cancer. And we do have some early studies ongoing at Yale now looking at that in lung cancer. So something we're very excited about. But these drugs, you know, do have the potential to be game changers. They have the potential to be game changers in metastatic disease as well as early stage disease.
And, you know, trying to dissect out anti-PD-1 versus anti-PD-L1, both Roy as well as Dave Spiegel, when they did their presentations, put up graphics. And it kind of looked like maybe anti-PD-L1 might be more specific, maybe it would end up being less toxic. Any thoughts in terms of the way they work?
So I think that it would be very hard to jump ahead now and guess which one might have more either specificity or toxicity profile. I just think we don't know that at this point. And I think that whether binding the ligand is more important than binding the receptor, I think is tough. And I think we've seen that in other areas of lung cancer biology, whether it's VEGF or whether it's anti-VEGF therapy or anti-VEGF receptor therapy. I think either way, I'm going to hold any kind of judgment, even mechanistically at this point. We just don't know enough. Now, interestingly, some people have argued, why not block both? What about combined PD-1 blockade? And again, that's an area of active interest. And there are phase one trials looking at PD-1 plus anti-PD-L1 at the same time.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't think about combining the two of them. I'm just kind of curious, have you yourself seen any patients or patients have been observed who got monotherapy with either one of these agents, clearly had prolonged responses with clinical benefit?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. So when I got to Yale, Scott Gettinger was one of the early investigators in the PD-1, PD-L1 world. And I had come from Harvard, where the MGH experience was very much biased toward kinase inhibitors and oncogene addiction. And came here, and Scott said, Tom, he said, you know, the kinase inhibitors are great, but he said, I got something that's unbelievable. Take a look at these patients. So we started treating people, and the benefits, single agent benefits, are remarkable. The side effect profile is dramatically less than what we see with chemotherapy or with kinase inhibitors. And the prolongation of benefit appears to be longer. Now, Neil, I'm one of the protocol chairs on the protocol committee for the randomized phase 3 trials that are being done now, looking at docetaxel versus anti-PD-1 in squamous cell patients and in adenocarcinoma patients. You really need phase 3 data to be able to make the kind of statements that you need to be able to make about toxicity and efficacy, because you have to be aware of the benefits of a promising single agent, small numbers trial. You really need the randomized trials to be able to answer that. But I'm very excited about what we see so far. And my prediction would be that this will become probably the single most used drug in lung cancer 3-4 years from now.
Another presentation I wanted to ask you about, another thing that made me excited about this year's ASCO, was the issue of looking at BRAF inhibitors in non-small cell lung cancer. And we saw a paper there looking at dabrafenib, which has been recently approved in melanoma, fairly small study looking at patients with BRAF mutations, but looked kind of interesting. Any thoughts about that paper?
So I think that as we do more genomic screening for lung cancer, BRAF is turning up in anywhere from 2-4% of the patients that get screened for lung cancer when you're screening. And I think it was encouraging to see activity in that group of patients, suggesting that they do have an oncogene-addicted tumor and can benefit from the compound. And so I do think that this could be another example of a disease subtype of lung cancer that could benefit from targeted therapy. And I know the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium is specifically excited about looking at this patient population. The frustrating thing for doctors is if you're not testing for BRAF in that setting, you're not going to find it. And the other issue is once you find it, how can you get these drugs reimbursed for your patient?
Are you yourself in your own practice at this point looking for BRAF mutations and thinking about BRAF inhibitors? I mean, we have two available.
So we are looking at BRAF mutations. We have a 409-gene panel at Yale that we do deep sequencing on. And I think what you're finding now around the country is every place is doing something slightly different. Some places are doing deep sequencing of a limited numbers of genes. Others are beginning to offer whole exome sequencing, although there are tons of problems with whole exome sequencing actually being done clinically. The bioinformatics around that is high. Others are looking at panels like the Foundation Medicine panel. There's a small Foundation panel, then a larger Foundation Medicine panel. So I think that this will be a big area of interest over the next 2-3 years as we sort out what the best way to molecularly profile patients. But as we molecularly profile more and more patients, you are going to find patients with druggable targets, HER2 amplification in lung cancer, HER2 mutation in lung cancer, being areas, I think, another example where we'll want to see, how does afatinib do in that setting? How does lapatinib do in that setting? How does trastuzumab do in that setting?
A couple other things that happened in ASCO in the realm of ALK and ROS1. First, we saw some data from another ALK inhibitor or another agent used with ALK rearrangements, LDK, with a bunch of numbers after that. Any comments on that? It looked pretty encouraging.
So that's a drug that my colleague Alice Shaw has had a large role in developing at the Massachusetts General Hospital. And Scott Gettinger has also treated patients here at Yale with the LDK compound. And I know there's terrific excitement about the next generation of ALK inhibitors, which are coming down the road. And these are drugs which have shown some promise, both in the setting of acquired resistance. There have been patients who've had benefit and response who had progressed on crizotinib. And then, of course, the question of whether or not these drugs are actually better first line. And so I am very excited about LDK as a potential agent in this setting.
So I think I'm up to about 5 mutations right now that at least are under consideration or possibilities in non-small cell. And the other one is ROS1. And we saw some more data on crizotinib and ROS1, Alice Shaw et al. At ASCO. Any comments on that alteration? How many patients have you seen with that and treated with it?
So I have never seen a patient with ROS1. I have seen Alice's patients that she's presented at ROS1. I think one of the interesting panels that I participated in, the 8 of us who were on the panel, no one had seen a patient with ROS1. And this was at Dr. Lilienbaum's winter lung meeting that you do with him. So it exists. The responses are terrific. But I think we all agree that it's not going to be a high volume mutation. But again, if you're not testing for it, you have no chance of finding it. If you're testing for it, you will occasionally find the rare patients. But in someone's practice life, they may only see 2 or 3 patients with ROS1.
And that also leads into the question of testing. And at that winter lung cancer meeting, actually, I think it was the very beginning of the meeting, one of the first things we did was ask people, and I think we started with you, about the algorithm for testing nowadays in non-small cell. You know, in breast cancer, we've had this sort of automatic, every piece of tissue you ever get's going to get HER2 and ER and PR. But in lung cancer, it always evolved, you know, in terms of trying to pick out the people who most likely would have it, the non-smokers, et cetera. Where are you today, and what do you think the rational algorithm is in general for testing?
So at this point, I think there's the question of what do we do at big cancer centers, and at larger cancer centers, you're seeing things like 409 gene panels and whole exome sequencing. The question is, what is evidence-based and what should be done in the community? And my feeling in the community is all patients with adenocarcinoma, non-squamous carcinoma, as opposed to saying adeno, because I think large cell should be lumped in with non-squamous. So patients with non-squamous cancers should get EGFR, should get ALK, should get ROS. I also believe should get RAF, should get HER2 as well. But that panel should be done at diagnosis in those patient populations. I think for patients with squamous, it's a little bit more difficult to be dogmatic about that since we don't have agents specifically in squamous or small cell that would drive that decision making.
What about surgically resected specimens?
Well, you have to ask yourself, would you do something with the information? So if I have a patient who is eligible for an adjuvant study with a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, knowing whether they have a mutation is important. However, if they're not eligible for a trial, I'm going to treat them just with chemotherapy. I'm not certain it's as essential at that point. One can certainly test when a treatment decision needs to be made. Now, with that said, we do test all resected specimens at our institution, but it varies from institution to institution. I think it's a little bit harder to be dogmatic if there's not a treatment decision that drives off of that.
Although an argument I've heard is that sometimes people present with metastatic disease, and even though the time to get these tests seems to be decreasing, there are situations where you really want to know it ahead of time.
That's a great argument, and I think that that's one of the advantages of doing reflex testing on all lung cancer patients. And I think as the cost of testing becomes more reasonable, the ease of testing, and the more it gets accepted, I think, Neil, eventually you're going to see that much more commonly done.